I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad. After every war since World War II, the United States has ordered the drawdown of its military forces. And now, after the long military engagement in both Iraq and Afghanistan, we're doing it again. This year, the military will cut around 50,000 troops. Here's Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
This is a budget that recognizes the reality of the magnitude of our fiscal challenges, the dangerous world we live in, and the American military's unique and indispensable role in the security of this country and in today's volatile world.
And once the preordained congressional cost-cutting measure known as the sequester kicks in, the military may have to cut another 30,000 troops over the next several years. This all comes at a time when President Obama is trying to rebalance the military and shift our focus to Asia.
I've said many times, the United States is and always will be a Pacific nation. America's security and prosperity is inseparable from the future of this region, and that's why I've made it a priority to renew American leadership in the Asia Pacific.
But while we shift that focus to deal with an increasingly assertive China and military tensions in the Pacific, we're also faced with an aggressive Russia snapping at the borders of Ukraine and a chaotic, nuclear-charged Middle East. And so the discussion now in Washington, in Brussels, in Tokyo, and elsewhere is whether the military cutbacks and troop drawdowns will only worsen the instability and endanger America's interests, or whether the U.S. can maintain its powerful and, some argue, stabilizing influence even with the cuts. In the next hour, we'll hear some of these arguments. We begin at the Pentagon with this report from Jennifer Strong.
I'm Christine Fox. I'm the Acting Deputy Secretary of Defense, and we're here in the Pentagon in my office.
When the military cuts the number of troops, it's called a drawdown. It's been done after every conflict since World War II. This year, the number of U.S. troops may shrink by 50,000, with the possibility of more cuts to come. But Fox says there's nothing else about this that's similar to past drawdowns.
It is the first time we've ever drawn down the force while we were still at war. So somebody deploys to Afghanistan and comes home and is told, you're out of a job. It's very challenging thing to do.
Another difference, according to Fox, she says there's no talk of a peaceful period ahead. The military calls that a peace dividend. Normally, it gives them time to rethink their priorities. But this time, the military sees no peace dividend. Instead, there are new security concerns from Europe to Asia to the Middle East. By comparison, this isn't the sharpest of drawdowns, but why cut the force now?
This is where the term hollow force comes from. You have a sizable force, can't do everything that you expect it to be able to do because it's too big for the budget that you've been given. We're determined not to let that happen to us this time. But that means we have to get smaller. We have to get a lot smaller, and we have to start yesterday.
The nation's defense budget is somewhere in the range of $600 billion. After years of growth following 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the defense budget is being cut. In 2012, President Obama made about $480 billion in cuts spread over several years. Then came the so-called sequester. It cuts defense spending by another $500 billion over the next decade. Deputy Secretary Fox.
And that requires us to come up with a lot of, frankly, politically challenging things such as changing the compensation for our military, or closing bases, or cutting an acquisition or modernization program, or reducing the size of forces.
Personnel costs are another challenge. This includes things like health care, pensions, and salaries. Those costs have been climbing about 60% faster than inflation. That means it costs more every year just to keep the same number of people. The Pentagon says these costs now make up half their budget. And Mark Gunzinger says these aren't the only problems the Pentagon faces. He's a senior fellow at the defense think tank, CSBA.
It's coming out of its longest war with a force that in some instances are the smallest it's ever had, the Air Force in particular. And it's the oldest Air Force, the fighters and bombers, that this nation has ever fielded.
And he says solutions to these problems require money.
So there's a need to recapitalize aging capabilities as well as modernize by buying the next generation of systems that will continue to give us a comparative edge over our future enemies.
But to do this, the Pentagon, White House, and Congress must work together. It requires some consensus on strategy, on how much to spend, and some tough decisions on what to cut. Gunzinger says Congress often ignores the Pentagon's opinion on hot-button issues. That leads to gridlock.
So if you can't retire old force structure, if you can't control the cost of your people programs, if you can't get rid of excess infrastructure through a BRAC process, get rid of old bases you simply don't need, if you can't shrink the size of the force, well, what's left? What's your choice?
The question is, what do we have a military for?
Retired Marine Major General Arnold Punaro.
So right now there are trade-offs going on in the Department of Defense between what I'd say are highly trained and well-equipped riflemen and happy retirees, and we're siding with the happy retirees. I'm glad our retirees are happy, but they don't deter aggression. They don't deter terrorists. We need to get back to the core missions of the Department of Defense, which are warfighting.
Even if Congress finds a way to roll back some of the spending cuts, disagreement about what to spend it on will remain a key issue, which raises the question, do the cutbacks in money, troops, infrastructure, do they have an effect on perceptions abroad? Mark Gunzinger says that is the case for allies overseas.
They're worried. They're worried about continuing turbulence in the defense programs that are important to them. They question whether or not we will have the resources to be able to rebalance the Asia-Pacific region.
Major General Punaro.
If you create a vacuum or a perception that you're not going to be engaged in parts of the world, our history shows that bad things happen. So instead of reforming how we spend the dollars internally, we're cutting the warfighting side of the military, we're cutting the troops, we're cutting our warfighting readiness.
For her part, Deputy Secretary Fox says all allies and adversaries deal with their own politics. She says President Obama and Secretary Hagel keep international lines of communication open.
These trips, these travels, these senior-level discussions that explain our system, what's going on, how we're handling it, I think can also be very reassuring to our allies and hopefully continue to send the messages we need to send to our potential adversaries.
As far as perception here in Washington, many cheer the idea of cutting spending. But no one seems to like the way the sequester caps spending across the board. Bill Hartung is a defense analyst at CIP.
The administration wants to break the caps. Many in Congress want to break the caps. Defense industry also wants to break the caps. But I think what they're up against is the larger budget politics. There's not going to be any give on taxes on the Republican side, no give on entitlements on the Democratic side.
So even if it's unpopular, the sequester is not an easy thing to fix. Congress must agree on an overall budget deal before they can increase the Pentagon's budget. For America Abroad, I'm Jennifer Strong in Washington.
Although Acting Deputy Defense Secretary Christine Fox says that America's allies are not concerned about cuts to the U.S. military, many experts disagree. Elliot Cohen is professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Of the U.S. troop drawdown, he says,
there's no question in my mind that it has sent a very, very bad signal.
A bad signal to leaders such as Russian President Vladimir Putin, whom he says sees the U.S. as an introspective superpower focused inward. Overall, he thinks the U.S. is projecting an image of weakness. And while the talk of military cuts may not have triggered Putin's decision to send in Russian troops and annex Crimea, it hasn't helped.
I think we have to be very concerned that having done that successfully with really paying no penalty whatsoever, somebody like Vladimir Putin, who isn't going to face any domestic controls whatsoever, probably doesn't even have somebody around him saying, boss, don't push this too far, will go further. And that at some point we're going to find ourselves really worrying about things lapping at the edge of NATO, which has been a core element in American foreign policy since the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you think that this puts the idea of drawing down the troops into a different kind of context and that the White House should reevaluate its plan to cut 50,000?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. But I think it actually goes further. When we brought the Baltic states and Poland in particular into NATO, in order to assuage Russian feelings, we basically agreed, in effect, not to have certainly any substantial military presence in those countries. That really has to change now, I think. I mean, the message has to be unambiguous. to the Russian government that those countries are part of NATO. They are covered by Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, that an attack against one is an attack against all. And the kind of force that's really indispensable for communicating that sort of commitment is ground forces. Moreover, there's another side to this, which is Europe has been on a path of unilateral disarmament for really a period of about two decades. And that has to be reversed. It really has to be. It'll be very hard for the United States to get our allies to do that if at the same time we're not willing to up our contribution to the defense of NATO.
But is that a different conversation than the conversation of cutting the Pentagon budget and cutting troop levels in the standing army? Is that a different conversation?
No, it's all the challenge is that it's all part of one big conversation. There are not two separate boxes, one called defense policy, one called foreign policy. They're connected. And what we sometimes forget is other countries pay attention to what the United States says and to what an American president or an American secretary of state says, but they pay even more attention to what we do. So the challenge that the United States has had since the end of World War II, which we continue to have, is a core principle of American foreign policy has been that we're committed to a certain kind of global order. We have maintained that. We have benefited from that enormously. Our allies have benefited from it enormously. It costs a certain amount of money to maintain that. And the steady decline in the size of our forces, including naval forces, really is going to put that in some considerable jeopardy.
Elliot Cohen is professor of strategic studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Coming up, more perspectives on the costs and benefits of slimming down America's military. You're listening to The Consequences of Shrinking America's Military on America Abroad. Do you think America is losing influence abroad by cutting back its military budget and troop strength? Let us know your thoughts. Send us a tweet at @America_abroad. I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to The Consequences of Shrinking America's Military on America Abroad. In countries like Estonia, one of the Baltic NATO allies that sits on the border of Russia, people are definitely paying attention to what the United States does in response to Russia's actions in Ukraine. As Elliot Cohen mentioned, NATO's longstanding policy has been to avoid antagonizing Moscow by putting troops either in the Baltic states or in Poland. But now, given Russia's interventions in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, NATO has responded by sending some limited ground forces and ordered extra air policing for the first time. Terry Schultz tracks the tense situation from the Estonian capital, Tallinn, and the Russian border.
Tangible reassurance against an aggressive Russia just next door. Estonians breathe a sigh of relief to get NATO boots on their ground, something Estonian President Tomas Ilves had adamantly argued was needed to deal with the unpredictable Russian threat.
Warriors, let me welcome you all to Estonia.
That's just 150 warriors at this point, along with extra NATO planes policing Baltic airways. But Ilves explains this isn't about numbers.
No one thinks that 150 troops are going to fend off a massive invasion. No, no one has that idea.
But what no one ever forgets in Estonia is that they share a 183-mile border with Russia, which forcibly annexed Estonia after World War II. Now Estonia is a NATO member, and Ilves says the deployment of the 173rd Airborne Division is proof the alliance will deliver on its sacred principle of collective defense.
If you're going to do something to one member of NATO, all of NATO is against you and with their full resources.
Estonian Air Force Commander Colonel Jaak Tarian says it's the American presence in particular that's reassuring.
This is the greatest deterrent effect there is, that any potential aggressor knows that they will be in direct conflict with the United States, and no one in the world at this point wants it.
This is one reason that the U.S. military drawdown worries many countries. While Estonian officials are pleased with the added NATO support, Russian President Vladimir Putin considers it a provocation. But that's only the most recent reason Putin's kept Estonia on his radar. The Russian president has a particular interest in the town of Narva. It's 130 miles east of the Estonian capital, separated geographically from Russia only by a modest river. separated linguistically and culturally by virtually nothing. More than 95% of Narva's population speaks Russian. Many have Russian passports, and they tell me they feel more Russian than Estonian. Like local club owner and entertainer Vladimir Sherdyakov. 23 years after Estonia regained its independence, Sherdyakov says Estonia is still trying to make its ethnic Russian population feel bad about the Soviet takeover in 1941.
Every day, everywhere, every newspaper, every radio, I listen only one phrase. Russian people, occupants. It's not our people. It's not our citizens. You are occupants.
Putin considers Narva's Russians his people. He suggests they're being mistreated by their own Estonian government and warns he may need to step in and protect them. That's the same rationale Putin gave for going into Crimea. Back in Tallinn, the Russian Cultural Center is buzzing with performances of traditional songs and dances. One way ethnic Russians keep their culture alive, even as many complain of hostility and discrimination from ethnic Estonians. Yevgeny Ossinovsky is one of those Russian speakers. He's the education minister, born not far from Narva, and he agrees ethnic Russians in Estonia have some valid grievances, difficulties integrating, getting citizenship, finding jobs. But Ossinovsky rejects any attempt to align him or other Estonian Russians with the Kremlin.
I don't want any representative of myself as a Russian speaker in Moscow. I don't have any links to that state. I've never been a citizen of Russia, and I really don't have anything in common with that country. So I really don't like, and I think majority of Russian speakers here don't like, the statements made by Moscow saying that, you know, we are standing for the interests of Russian speakers, blah, blah, blah.
But NATO can't afford to just dismiss the Russian narrative as blah, blah, blah. At NATO headquarters, Deputy Secretary General Alexander Virchow, who's also been the U.S. ambassador to Russia, considers the Narva invasion scenario highly unlikely, but not impossible.
The expansive doctrine that Putin has enunciated means we can't completely dismiss the notion that he might create some kind of provocations, try to intimidate some members of the alliance. They have tried to fan the flames of Russian nationalism in Latvia and in Estonia.
Assessing the threat, the alliance's Supreme Allied Commander Europe, U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, says he examines the combination of capability and intent. He says Crimea has shown what Russia's intent could be elsewhere. Breedlove says NATO is looking at a different Russia than it thought it was, and looking at itself in a different way, too.
We have to sit back and reevaluate our force posture and our force readiness to say, are we prepared to meet the threat that is represented by a snap exercise which generates a huge, capable force right on a NATO boundary? Are we ready to meet that threat?
NATO officials acknowledge it's a fine line they're treading now, ramping up operations enough to deter Kremlin notions of threatening an ally. While not pushing it so far, it could provoke a Russian military reaction. In the nearest term, Breedlove is considering options such as changing the timing, scale, or location of NATO exercises already on the books, or drawing exercises planned among several allies under the NATO mantle to underscore that any threat will meet a 28-nation response. In May, thousands of NATO troops will be in Estonia for Exercise Spring Storm, while Poland hosts Exercise Orzel Alert. And Breedlove also will continue to push his case with Washington policymakers that the U.S. troop level in Europe must not be decreased at all. He says the American military presence was at its bare-bones minimum to do everything it needed to do, even before Crimea. Colonel Tharian in Tallinn hopes Breedlove's arguments convince American decision-makers.
We would hope that the current events in Ukraine will reverse this decision and U.S. presence will not be reduced and hopefully steadily grow back to, not to Cold War levels, but about to the level of 10 years ago.
And even with frequent threats toward his country coming from the Kremlin, Tharian says keeping U.S. troops in Europe will prevent war from ever happening again on this continent. For America Abroad, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Admiral James Stavridis led the NATO alliance as Supreme Allied Commander from 2009 to 2013.
Naturally, our European friends are concerned. Therefore, they're watching very closely as we draw down ground forces and aircraft fighters out of Europe.
He's currently the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He agrees with General Breedlove in opposing the troop drawdown. The current plan is to withdraw our fighter aircraft and two of our brigade combat teams, BCTs as they're known. He says,
I think we should pause that immediately and assess the situation and then consider anew what an adequate force posture in Europe is. My inclination is, given recent events surrounding Ukraine, that we're going to want to sit at least three, if not four, brigade combat teams in Europe.
Not only do we need to maintain a reasonable level of troop strength, but he says the Allies need to do their part.
They do spend a significant amount on defense, but as a percentage of their GDP, they spend well under 2%, yet the stated NATO goal is 2% spending on GDP. Over on the Japan side of the equation, likewise, we should be encouraging Japan to be spending adequately on defense.
Despite the anxiety the Allies have about our force cutbacks, Stavridis thinks the administration has done a reasonably good job managing the crisis in Ukraine.
Well, I think it's a very tough hand of cards for anybody to play. Broadly speaking, the president and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State have tried very hard in Ukraine, for example, to rally the global community against this. That ended up successfully with a vote in the United Nations, where only 10 nations supported the Russian activities in Ukraine. Secondly, they've worked very hard to reassure European and NATO allies, and they've done a good job, I think, of moving additional forces into the Baltic states, Poland, and so forth.
That said, Stavridis believes that the Obama administration could do more to help Ukraine defend itself.
I would personally advocate a higher degree of military assistance to Ukraine. The more that Russia looks across that border and sees a capable Ukrainian military, the less likely they are to make a strategic mistake and invade Ukraine proper. So I would say increasing the amount of intelligence, information, ammunition, weapons, logistics, fuel, and indeed NATO advisors on the ground, I think would be a smart way to approach it.
And Admiral Stavridis believes that there should be a pause in the overall cuts to the U.S. military as well.
The most important thing we can do is be thinking holistically and strategically about how to spend the money. And I'd underline again that I think the defense cuts we've faced up to this point are sufficient, and we should not cut further.
But experts like Gordon Adams are not as worried about our ability to protect our interests and those of our allies, even with the current defense cuts. Adams is a professor of international relations at American University in the School of International Service.
Keep in mind that the American military is still overall the largest and the most technologically sophisticated and by far the only global military capability in the entire world. We're the only country that can sail everywhere, fly everywhere, deploy troops everywhere. We're the only country with global logistics and communications and intelligence and the capacity to operate. No other country maintains this capability. So larger or smaller relative to where it's been, we will remain the only global military.
Well, we've spoken to several people who say, yeah, perhaps they have the capability to do that, but it'll be at quite a price. They'll be stretched thin. They will not be at their most optimal readiness when it comes to tackling these threats.
We have never been as secure as a nation as we are today. And what I mean by that is we don't face an existential threat. And many of the upheavals and challenges that are happening on a regional basis do not directly impact the American military, even its allies, or the interests of the United States abroad directly. There's almost no country in the world that doesn't worry about the capabilities of the United States military.
So perhaps we don't face an obvious existential threat, such as the one you mentioned, or from other countries. But is there also a concern that we face something that is less direct in countries that don't necessarily provide a direct existential threat to us, but provide perhaps an existential threat to the world order?
The world is changing in really unusual ways right now. I like to say we're really seeing a rebalancing of the international system. With the rise of countries like China, like India, like Brazil, the assertiveness of Russia, and even countries like Iran or Turkey or South Africa, we're seeing a fundamental restructuring of the international system. And where the United States once assumed that it played this global leadership and stabilizing role, I say assumed it, we're really in a situation where we're going to have to share that responsibility. And it isn't a question so much of American decline as it is, if you will, the rise of the others around the world.
However, there is this perception that the military could respond, if it needed to any threat. And I'm wondering if that perception is being threatened at all on the part of our allies by these cuts to the military in terms of the ground forces and just the general members of the military, the size of the defense budget.
I don't think so. I actually think most of the world is not too concerned about whether the United States remains committed or can actually deploy forces. There's not another country in the world that can deploy forces the way the United States can deploy forces. So I think there's a gap here between the reality of the American military capability and the rhetoric of concern.
The opinions of Gordon Adams. He's professor of international relations at American University.
I think the weakness is something that people worry about in their more paranoid moments abroad.
That's Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
And then you remind them of some of these points and, you know, they have to come back and look at the facts. And when they do, the facts look pretty good. America's still pretty strong. Its alliances are pretty strong. Its allies are strong.
While O'Hanlon agrees with Gordon Adams that the U.S. is still the overwhelming military power, he worries more about the situation in Europe. O'Hanlon argues that if President Putin were to move into eastern Ukraine, NATO should respond by stationing some ground forces in the Baltic states and perhaps Poland indefinitely.
They should not be accompanied by a lot of armor or tactical fighter aircraft or any other kind of power projection and offensive capability. It should be very clear they're not there to threaten Russia or to try to take back Ukraine or Crimea. They're there to reassure our allies and reinforce the message. We're all in this together.
The U.S. must reassure in the East as well as in Europe, says O'Hanlon. That was the purpose of President Obama's recent trip to Japan as part of his pivot to Asia.
We're trying to send friends and allies and potential nemeses in that region a message that we are reinvigorating our approach to that region, that we're back, that we're no longer as distracted by the post-9/11 wars as we once were. And you want to have a Navy that's stronger in the Asia-Pacific in the coming years than it has been in recent years.
We'll hear more about that trip and how it was perceived in Japan in a moment. And we'll review how our military drawdown is going over in part of the Middle East. You're listening to The Consequences of Shrinking the American Military on America Abroad. For photos from some of our stories and for more on this conversation, visit our website, americaabroad.org. I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to The Consequences of Shrinking America's Military on America Abroad. We go to Japan now. Since World War II, it's been the centerpiece of American security in the Pacific. About 50,000 U.S. troops and 85 facilities are based there, along with the U.S. 7th Fleet. But with the U.S. military shrinking and China flexing its muscles over what Japan calls the Senkaku Islands, the Japanese have become increasingly worried about the strength of that U.S. commitment to the defense of Japan. President Obama's recent Asia tour and his so-called pivot to Asia was meant to reassure Japan and America's Asian allies. Lucy Kraft reports.
The U.S.-Japan alliance is the foundation for not only our security in the Asia-Pacific region, but also for the region as a whole.
President Obama's recent trip to Japan was packed with photo ops, but for many Japanese, the moment that really mattered was a single soundbite.
That our treaty commitment to Japan's security is absolute, and Article 5 covers all territories under Japan's administration,
including the Senkaku Islands.
The Senkaku Islands, tiny, uninhabited islets in the East China Sea, claimed by both Japan and China, have become a dangerous flashpoint. President Obama's terse statement reaffirming America's treaty obligations to protect the territory drew a strident response from Beijing, which announced it will stage joint military exercises with Russia near the sensitive area this month. Meanwhile, Obama's Senkaku Declaration was warmly welcomed by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Barack, together I hope we can build the best U.S.-Japan relationship ever.
But America's show of resolve did not reassure Yumiko Kato, a teacher in Tokyo.
I think it was just lip service. I'm worried about the ability of the Obama administration to deliver on its promises.
Japan has been used to the idea of having American military protection without really having to put Japanese lives on the line.
Andrew Horvat, a visiting professor at Tokyo's Josei International University, says the waning of U.S. wealth and power and influence in the Far East, a region it dominated throughout the Cold War era, has bred uncertainty among allies like Japan.
Are we going to be abandoned? Meaning the United States and China are now mutually so interdependent that the Japanese are asking themselves, what is the value of this American commitment to help us if America's hands are tied, if America's, you know, national debt is in the hands of Chinese?
Obama's visit was supposed to allay those fears, putting weight behind the rhetoric of his so-called pivot to Asia, de-emphasizing the Mideast to focus on the world's most economically vibrant region. Washington says the pivot means two more Aegis destroyers will be sent to Japan by 2017. More subs, drones, and other surveillance and reconnaissance systems are expected to follow, underscoring U.S. resolve in a region alarmed by China's moves to expand its borders in the East and South China Seas. Michael Chuchik is an adjunct fellow at Temple University, Japan.
We have the world's second largest economy, China, rapidly militarizing at rates far above those of any of its neighbors and also of the United States. The ability of neighbors to keep up, particularly Japan, is limited.
Japan scrambled fighter jets over 800 times in the last year. That's the highest level since the Cold War. More than half of these dispatches were related to the Senkaku standoff, which escalated last year with China's provocative unilateral declaration of an air defense identification zone in the East China Sea. The move drew condemnation from U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel in Beijing recently.
Every nation has a right to establish air defense zones, but not a right to do it unilaterally. That adds to tensions and eventually get to dangerous conflict.
But the pivot to Asia coincides with record low support among Americans for an active foreign policy. Putting U.S. troops in harm's way over a few rocks in the East China Sea, as in the Senkaku's dispute, might find even less favor. But scholar Andrew Horvat says that especially in a post-Crimea world, Washington is obliged to intervene.
You don't change boundaries unilaterally. You recognize boundaries that are internationally accepted. You don't suddenly declare an air defense identification zone and demand of absolutely everybody to call you before they go through there. And I think those principles are important.
Kuni Miyake, research director of the Cannon Institute for Global Studies, agrees that the U.S. can't afford to sit on the sidelines.
The bottom line is that this is for the mutual benefit, not only for us, but for the U.S. interest, for the United States to stay here. And if the United States do not respond to a situation, then probably that's when the United States decided to leave. I don't think that's going to be the case.
Even so, the rise of a more powerful China has conservative Prime Minister Shinzo Abe not satisfied just to sit by and rely on U.S. military commitments. In what he calls proactive pacifism, Abe is pushing for a constitutional amendment that would allow Japan to engage in collective defense. He rammed a tough new espionage law through Parliament and, for the first time in almost 50 years, relaxed Japan's ban on military exports to allow the sharing of defense technology with allies, all measures also long sought by Washington as a way of strengthening the alliance.
Exercising the right of collective self-defense is indispensable for Japan.
Narushige Michishita, Director of Security and International Studies at the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies, says that Japan has no choice but to strengthen its defense ties with other countries in the region as a counterweight to China's growing military might.
This is not about the containment of China. The most important strategic objective that we have is to maintain the balance of power.
Maintaining that balance will prove complex in a region still lacking a shared vision, still deeply riven by its troubled history, 7 decades after the end of World War II. For America Abroad, I'm Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
Back here in the U.S., senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, Michael O'Hanlon, gives the Obama administration high marks in one aspect of his recent trip to Asia, reassuring our allies.
By being stalwart on the alliance, by generally being committed to the region, reinvigorating his own rebalance, Obama did most of what people in the region could have asked, and probably all that he should have done on this issue at this moment.
But as for the long-term military strategy?
The enduring specific question remains, what would we do if there were a brouhaha over the Senkaku Islands, or some kind of an encounter that involved naval vessels in which damage was done or lives lost, and Japan felt that some kind of a reprisal action or a retaliatory action was in order, and maybe we would agree and maybe not. So I don't think the president advanced that conversation too much.
A key part of the Pentagon's pivot to Asia is an increase in naval deployments from 50% to 60% by the year 2020. But O'Hanlon says that increase won't matter if the overall force is reduced by the sequester.
We want to beef up our overall Air Force and Navy capabilities in that region in particular. The problem is that even if we try to increase the percentage of our Navy in the Asia Pacific, if the overall size of the Navy comes down too much, the net effect will be to reduce the number of ships available for the Pacific. In other words, you can increase the percentage of a smaller pie and wind up with less. You can wind up with fewer ships than you had before. That would be a very counterproductive message to send. You want to have a Navy that's stronger in the Asia Pacific in the coming years than it has been in recent years.
And finally, there is, of course, the ongoing U.S. military requirements in the Middle East.
It's not really going to be possible to fully turn our back from the Middle East. Those are the difficult ground missions for planning purposes, in my judgment.
Europe and Asia are not the only parts of the world worried about the depth of the U.S. commitment. In the Middle East, America has traditionally had strong relations with the Gulf states. For generations, oil-rich Saudi Arabia and the five Gulf states have been the hub of the world's energy economy. But because they're surrounded by hostile forces and failed states, they have relied on American military power to protect their sea lanes and territory. In response to the criticism from U.S. allies in the region, U.S. Ambassador William J. Burns recently reiterated America's commitment to the Gulf in a speech at Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Indeed, our security commitments and partnerships in the Gulf are more extensive today than ever before. Our military presence includes more than 35,000 ground, air, and naval personnel at more than a dozen bases in and around the Gulf. We've deployed our most advanced systems to the region, our most advanced aircraft and our most advanced munitions, our most advanced intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, and our most advanced missile defense capabilities.
And yet, Gulf leaders today worry that Washington will not be there to guarantee their security over the next generation, whether due to shrinking troop levels and budget cutbacks, or the pivot to Asia, or a new American approach to Iran. Saudi Arabia's Turad al-Amri is a former fighter pilot in the Saudi Air Force who studied international relations in Phoenix, Arizona. He's now a leading voice on Gulf policy and strategy due to his widely read column in the Saudi-owned newspaper Al-Hayat.
The Gulf, they are perceiving a threat from unstable countries. If the United States didn't guarantee the security of the Gulf states by certain conditions on Iraq, on Iran, on Israel, then it will be very dangerous. The Gulf people, they will feel they are betrayed by the United States.
There's always been tension between Gulf leaders and Washington, as Al-Amri suggests, and that's due in part to the difference in political systems. Gulf leaders don't run for office. They think decades ahead when they formulate policies, whereas in the U.S. system, policies are more vulnerable to the ebb and flow of voter demands.
People don't trust much the United States. Because the pragmatism within the United States, the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, the economic problem within the United States and Europe after 2008-2009, give a feeling that the United States care about their own interests, and therefore they choose to abandon their allies. The most important shift happened a few months ago when the United States decided to go to the other side of the Gulf and make a deal with Iran. That's a real nail in the coffin of the relations.
The Obama administration is now negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program. Should the two sides cut a deal and end their three decades of mutual hostility, Gulf leaders worry the U.S. will accept a new Iranian hegemony over their region. And so the Gulf states and their new ally, Egyptian leader Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, are trying to put together new arms agreements with China, Russia, and other powers. They're trying to anticipate a possible reduction of American military support, says Tarad al-Amri.
Egypt, for instance, are getting some armed deals with Russia. And Saudi Arabia, a long time ago, about 20 or 25 years ago, have seek some assistance from China with regard to the missiles. Now, if the United States now decide and the Gulf states confirm their intention that they will be left alone, so they have no other alternative but to go to different powers such as Russia or China.
And if the American military footprint does diminish there, Al-Amri says, they'll have to choose. They'll have to choose between cutting their own deal with Iran or building a new military coalition to counter Iran on their own.
Saudi and Iranian, they are now testing the water in order to have a good relations, A. B, Saudi Arabia, they are having their alternative plan with Egypt, Pakistan, in addition to United Arab Emirates and Kuwait, to do some kind of alliance that might balance the power in the Gulf.
And that possible alliance, in which the Gulf states and Egypt band together with nuclear-armed and unstable Pakistan to create a new deterrent, could be dangerous. So given all these worries from America's allies in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East for U.S. commitments abroad, U.S. military and political leaders fret about getting the defense budget cuts right. Of the range of experts we spoke to, many of them agreed on this point. Because of budget realities, there will be cuts to the U.S. military. The issue is not whether to cut, it's how to cut. Todd Harrison is the Senior Fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
The problem is if you just get smaller but you don't address the sources of internal cost growth, then eventually you're going to have to keep getting smaller and smaller, and you'll price yourselves out of the ability to field a military of any significant size.
So what is the solution, do you think, for internal cost growth?
Well, you know, we've got to do some politically unpopular things, like reform the military compensation system, which is a very antiquated system. You know, it goes back decades. It doesn't fully address the needs of an all-volunteer force. It's not fair in the way that it compensates people, because the vast majority of people join the military and just serve a few years and get out and go on to other careers, and they do not enjoy many of the expensive benefits that we give to the career people who stay in the military 20 years. You know, they don't. If you leave after 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, you have absolutely no retirement. You have absolutely no health care after that point from the military. So you lose all of that. The other thing we got to do is look at closing excess bases and facilities. That's one of the things that's driving up internal costs within DOD, is that Congress has prohibited them from closing bases and facilities that they don't need anymore.
Gordon Adams, professor of international relations at American University, takes aim at the back office, as he calls it, the administrative part of the Defense Department.
The back office is incredible. If you look at the numbers, we've got 800,000 civil servants working for the Department of Defense. It's a third of the federal government's entire civil service. We have got 350,000, roughly, people who are working in uniform in civilian or commercial jobs, right, that are not at the point of the spear. They are not supporting the point of the spear. They are doing jobs that other people could do or not be done at all. And we have 700,000 people who are basically individual contractors working for the Department of Defense as services contractors. When I add up those numbers, I get 1.8 million people who are doing essentially administrative functions for a force of 1.1 million in uniform at the point of the spear. That's a huge back office, and that is, it's fiscally expensive. It's well more than half of the entire defense budget. It is not very efficient, and it is the fiscal trade space for the secretary.
And Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, adds the planned cuts hurt America's military readiness.
Let me give you a couple of examples. First, 52% of the Pentagon budget goes to personnel costs. And that's not just pay, it's retirement, it's non-monetary benefits like commissaries and other things. And the president, by executive order, excluded sequestration from applying to that. So 50% of the budget was off limits from the start, and that exacerbated what you needed to cut in the procurement programs and in training and operations.
Right. And in fact, I think salaries are going to go up, or they won't be cut anyway.
Yeah. So for me, the two telling statistics are that the defense budget has doubled since 2001, and that pay and benefits have gone up by almost 85% also in that time. And that made a certain amount of sense when you were recruiting soldiers and the country was fighting two wars. And because we did not have a big enough army for the wars we were fighting, the size of the Army and the Marine Corps were rapidly expanded during wartime. And that makes recruiting a challenge, and the services managed it extraordinarily well. But the kinds of benefits you need to offer to soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen in those circumstances are different from the recruiting circumstances where we are cutting the Army by over 100,000 soldiers and cutting the Marine Corps by about 15,000.
If you could be the person who allocates the Pentagon budget, what would it look like?
It would look like a ramping down of personnel costs, in particular the costs of family health care, where military families can and should pay a little bit more in order to keep the system solvent. Secretary Gates routinely would talk about how health care spending in the Pentagon budget had gone from $19 billion to $52 billion in his time as secretary. That is a rate of growth that will simply crowd out our ability to buy the weapons that keep service members dominant and alive on battlefields, and it crowds out the training that does the same kinds of things.
You're saying that personnel costs are the single biggest money waster in the Pentagon, right?
There are certainly other competitors, though. It is one of the myths of Washington that the Pentagon spends money efficiently, but every other arm of the American government spends it badly. In fact, the Pentagon wastes an awful lot of taxpayers' money. They cannot, and have said they will not be able to until 2017, pass the kind of basic audit of their spending that every American business is required to do.
You know, there are some people who say, look, bureaucracy and waste, that's just a fact of life when it comes to the military. And it's just the price you pay for having a very strong and powerful military.
Well, there's certainly some truth to that. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan, and my ball club always wins games when they are profligate, stranding runners on base. It is inefficient to put runners on base without scoring them, but that means that the overall offense is incredibly dynamic, and that's why they're winning games. And that is the argument for not worrying too much about fat in the defense budget. But That strikes me as a poor argument to make with public money. And it also strikes me as something that the Pentagon itself builds into its budget of funding factors that say they're going to get a lot more efficient at this, and they just never seem to.
And here's the bigger difficulty. No matter how much policy analysts and military officials debate this issue, that is, the issue of how best to maintain U.S. warfighting capabilities, the outcome ultimately lies largely out of their reach. The future of U.S. defense policy rests in the hands of politicians, of members of Congress, who must either find a way to work together to break the hold of pre-planned budget cuts or live with the consequences. This Hour was written and edited by Martha Little and produced by Rob Sachs with help from Flawn Williams. Additional production help at KCRW was provided by Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, and Andrew Walsh. You can hear past programs by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes, finding us on the TuneIn or Public Radio International apps, or by visiting our website, americaabroad.org. I'm Madeline Brand, and this is America Abroad from Public Radio International. Support for this show was provided by Public Radio International stations and listeners like you. Support was also provided by the Stewart Family Foundation and Turkish Airlines.
PRI, Public Radio International.